attractive, at least. She had delivered most of the autobiographical speech very shyly, with her eyes downcast, glancing anywhere but into David Hudson's eyes. Color had crept up from her neck, finally covering her entire face. "I'd made a few tiny misjudgments myself. Just a few," Hudson laughed then. So many stored-up emotions were being released inside him now. It had been so long since he'd allowed himself this. Billy began to laugh again. "Oh, to hell with the past," she said, her eyes a little sad, however, ironic, slightly pinched at the corners. They both ran out of words at exactly the same time. The moment seemed especially poignant for some reason, confused, with far too many emotional cross-currents. Billy finally turned to face Hudson again. She spoke very softly, feathers of her warm breath lightly touching his ear. "Please kiss me, David. That might not sound like anything so very dramatic, except that I don't think I've said it to anyone and meant it since I was about 16 or 17 years old." Hudson and Billy Bogan, her slender body loose and pliant, his strong, almost at military attention, kissed in the shadows of the grand Christmas tree at Rockefeller Center. Holiday music sweetly played around them. Adeste Fidelis, Silent Night, Joy to the World. For that moment, at least, Hudson conveniently forgot his other plans for the world. Not joy, exactly. No, something else that was badly needed, though. Justice for mankind. Revenge for a special few. Chapter 76. Caitlin Dillon hurriedly entered the crowded conference room inside number 13 wall. She passed repairmen plastering over cracks in cement. Three cleaning women hauled buckets at the end of the hallway, clanking as they moved. Caitlin paused at the buzzing entrance to the conference room and raised one hand to her hair. She was thinking how much she missed Carol, who was expected back from Washington at any moment. He'd called, but his voice had been strained, almost as if he'd been afraid to tell her anything. She stepped into the meeting room, passing through a phalanx of policemen and army personnel. The word had already spread up and down the hallways. There had been some sort of break in the Green Band investigation. Finally, a break. Walter Trentkamp of the FBI stood in silence before the restless audience. He was obviously tense. Streaks of light sweat highlighted his face, and the collar of his shirt was damp. Trentkamp cleared his throat. The scene reminded Caitlin of high-level press conferences held in Washington, emergency meetings called on short notice. "You have no doubt heard the rumor that a significant development has occurred in the Green Band case. It was uncovered through the tireless effort of Captain Francis Niccolo and Sergeant Rizzo in NYPD ballistics." Niccolo, waxy frank, appeared in the crowd alongside Joe Rizzo. Both men were beaming, taking an imperceptible bow. "These men have been working tirelessly since the bombings on December 4th. Their labors have paid a big dividend." There were a couple of appreciative mumbles in the room and a half-hearted attempt at applause. Niccolo and Rizzo shuffled their feet like schoolboys at an honors presentation. "Sergeant," Trentkamp said, "come up here, please." Rizzo awkwardly stepped forward, hoisting a styrofoam chart up on a metal stand. On the chart, a police artist had sketched the major buildings of the financial district in black and white. The structures which had been bombed were colored traffic signal red. Each of the bombed-out buildings also had a bold violet ring drawn around it. Caitlin noticed that the purple rings were at widely different levels on the 14 building. Rizzo began. "The buildings marked with red were all hit around 6:30 on December 4th. The bombs were definitely detonated by remote signals. The signal might have been operated from as far away as 8 to 10 miles. Rizzo paused. blew his nose unselfconsciously on a big white handkerchief, then went on. The violet rings on the buildings were drawn to indicate where the explosions actually took place. The plastique packages were actually placed here, 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 etc. As you can see, the plastique was planted on different floors in all 14 buildings. The second floor at 22 Broad, 15th floor at Manufacturers Hanover, and so on. You can see that plainly. Rizzo looked around at the faces in the room as if he were challenging someone to disagree. There's no special pattern to this. At least, that's what we've thought up to now. Last night, though, we found a connection we'd missed. Look here. Each of the circled floors actually contains one of that building's messenger drop-off and pickup rooms, either a drop-off or a package mail station. What threw us off this approach was the fact that messenger drop-off stations and the mail room in these buildings isn't always the same, not even on the same floor. Some of the Wall Street buildings have drop-off stations on every floor. You all see what I'm driving at? Sergeant Rizzo paused for effect. Rizzo said, "Gentlemen, the bombs were all hand-delivered, probably by a regular commercial messenger who would go unnoticed." Rizzo once again looked around the quiet room. There are more than 200 messenger services in and around Wall Street. Jimmy Split, Speedo, Fireball, Bullet, to name a few. You've seen most of them yourselves. Chances are at least one of them was contacted by our friends Green's band. Perhaps several were used to deliver the plastique on December 4th. Rizzo paused again. What this means is that some goofball messenger is going to help break this thing open. Tonight, we hit the streets and run this thing down to earth. Caitlin felt the tremendous energy that coursed through their meeting room as the men began to disperse. They had come alive after days of pounding on unyielding walls, days of pursuing an investigation that had been going absolutely nowhere. She was almost swept aside as policemen and detectives crushed toward the door. A Wall Street messenger service. A shiver suddenly traveled through her. Messenger service? Caitlin turned and left the meeting room. She started back in the direction of her own office. She had just remembered something, except she wasn't sure now if her memory was playing tricks on her. Caitlin started to run down the corridor inside number 13. Chapter 77. Carol was certain he had been followed back from Washington. A dark car had tracked his checker taxicab from Kennedy Airport all the way into the financial district. When he stepped out of the taxi at number 13 Wall, the tracking car went skirting past. He couldn't see faces inside, only shapes, two or three men huddled together. Why were they following him? Who had sent them? Who was tracking the tracker? He disappeared inside number 13 and went straight to Caitlin's office on the second floor. He hurried because he was filled with the strongest need to see her, to talk to somebody he could trust. She rose from behind her desk where she'd been studying a printout of the names of U.S. veterans the computer had supplied before. She stepped out to hug him, and Carol didn't seem to want to let her go. They pressed tightly into one another's bodies. Caitlin finally disentangled herself. How was Washington? He told her about the FBI's file on David Hudson, about his visit with General Lucas Thompson. Caitlin brought him up to the moment on developments explained by Sergeant Rizzo. She indicated the computer printout she'd been studying when he had arrived. Maybe this is coincidence. Maybe it doesn't mean a thing. But on this FBI list of veterans, there's an explosives expert whose occupation is cab driver and messenger. The home address is New York City. Which name? Carol asked. He was already scanning the lengthy list. A man called Michael Daoud, who just happened to serve under Colonel David Hudson in Vietnam. Does it say which messenger service? Carol looked up from the printout. Caitlin shook her head. It shouldn't be too difficult to find out. Let's see. Carol waited while Caitlin made a quick couple of telephone calls. He slid his investigation notebook out of his coat and impatiently flipped through those familiar pages that had chronicled Green Van's false starts and stops from the beginning. There were several different organizational headings now. Interviews, physical evidence, suspects, miscellaneous. David Hudson, the mastermind of all this chaos? West Point, 1966, Special Forces, Rangers, Golden Boy? Fort Bragg, JFK Training School, severe stress testing, experimentation with drugs, preparing Hudson for what? Special terrorist training. By whose orders? Where did that chain of command end? Carol finally shut the notebook in frustration. What do I know that I don't know I know? Carol's thoughts went back to Green Van. What could I know? What have I seen that's crucial? Washington, D.C.? General Lucas Thompson? He watched Caitlin put the telephone receiver down. Vets, cabs, and messengers, she said with a sudden grin. They have a garage near here in the village. Carol stood up. Call Philip Berger. Then could you call Trent Camp? Tell them to get their men organized, to meet me at... Caitlin interrupted. There's more, Arch. She paused for just a beat. David Hudson works there, too. He's been there for over a year. Chapter 78. Just past midnight on December 18th, Colonel Hudson emotionally addressed the assembly of 24 vets gathered inside the Jane Street garage. This has been a long and particularly hard mission for you, he said. I know that. But at each important stage, you've done everything that has been asked of you. I feel humble standing here before you. Hudson paused and looked over the upturned faces that watched him motionlessly. As we approach the final stages of Green Band, I want to stress one thing. I don't want anyone to take needless risks. Is that understood? Take no chances. Our ultimate goal from here on is zero KIA. Again, Hudson paused. When he finally spoke, there was an uncharacteristic edge of emotion in his voice. This will be our last mission together. Thank you once again. I salute you all. From that moment, Green Band was designed to be a thoroughly disciplined, army-style field maneuver. Every detail had been scrutinized. The grease-stained garage doors at Vets Cab and Messengers rolled open with a heavy metallic roar. Diffuse amber headlights suddenly pierced the darkness. Vets 5, Harold Friedman, ran outside the Vets building. He looked east and west on Jane Street. Then Friedman began to bark orders like the Army drill sergeant he'd once been. It was just past 12:30 a.m. If anyone in the West Village neighborhood saw the three Army transport trucks emerge from the garage, they paid little attention, in the tried and true tradition of New Yorkers. The trucks finally hurtled up 10th Avenue. Hudson crouched forward in the passenger seat of the lead troop truck. He was in constant walkie-talkie contact with the two other troop transports. This was a disciplined Army field maneuver in every respect. They were moving into full combat again. None of them had realized how much they missed it. Even Hudson had forgotten the clarity that came before a major battle. There was nothing like this anywhere in life. Nothing to compare. Contact, this is Vets 1. You are to follow us straight down 10th Avenue to the Holland Tunnel entrance. We'll be maintaining strict military speed limits inside the city. So sit back. Just relax for the ride. Over. 2 hours passed before the lead transport truck pulled to a shuddering stop at a military guard post less than 60 yards off Route 34 in New Jersey. Over the wooden sentry box, the sign said, Fort Monmouth, United States Army Post. The Army private on duty had been close to falling asleep. His eyes were glazed behind horn-rimmed glasses and his movements wooden as he approached the Lee transport truck. "Identification, sir." The private cleared his throat. He didn't look much more than 18 years old to Hudson. Shades of Vietnam, of wars fought by boys. Hudson silently handed across two plastic ID cards. The cards identify him as Colonel Roger McAfee of the 68th Street Armory, Manhattan. The inspection that followed was pro forma. The regular duty guard speech was given by the sentry. "You may proceed, sir. Please obey all posted parking and traffic regulations while you are a visitor at Fort Monmouth. Are those transport vehicles behind with you, sir?" "Yes. We're going on bivouac. We're here to pick up supplies. Small arms and ammunition for our weekend in the country. Two helicopters have been requisitioned. They'll have the details inside. I'm to see Captain Harney." "You can all proceed then, sir." The Army base sentry finally stepped aside. He crisply waved the small Army reserve convoy onward. "Contact, this is Vets 1. As soon as they passed the gate, Colonel Hudson spoke into the PRC transmitter. "We're now less than 12 hours until the termination of the operation code named Green Band. Everyone is to use extreme, repeat, extreme caution. We're almost home, gentlemen." Chapter 79. Inconspicuous and drab, the Vet's garage on Jane Street wasn't the kind of place to draw attention. It sat in the middle of a West Village block, its large metal doors rusted and grease-stained and bleak. At both ends of the block, the desolate street had silently been cordoned off. NYPD patrol cars were positioned everywhere around the garage. Carol counted 17 of them. Beneath the darkened edifice of a Shell gas station, he could see unmarked FBI cars and as many as 30 heavily armed agents. The police and the FBI agents carried M16 automatic assault rifles, 12-gauge riot shotguns, 357 Magnum. It was as frightening an attack force and arsenal as Carol had ever seen. Carol leaned against his own car, studying the metal doors, the crooked, bleached sign that read, "Vets, Cabs, and Messengers." He tapped his fingers on the car hood. Something was wrong here. Something was wrong again. Carol peered hard in the direction of the Shell station. The FBI guy stood perfectly still, waiting for the signal that would bring them rushing into action. At his side was Walter Trentkamp. Carol had kept Walter informed. Now Trentkamp was inside the maze with him. Carol took out his Browning. He turned the weapon over in the palm of his hand and thought it was strange how some voice inside was telling him to be careful. Careful, he thought. He hadn't been careful before, so why start now? Carol thought he knew why. "Archer," Walter nudged him. A limousine was suddenly threading its way down the grim, quiet street. Police Commissioner Michael Caine solemnly climbed out. The commissioner, whose street experience was limited and who was more politician than cop, had a bullhorn in one hand. "Oh, Christ, no," Carol muttered. Commissioner Caine's voice echoed down the West Village street. "Attention! This is Commissioner of Police Caine. You have 1 minute to emerge from the Vets garage. You have 60 seconds before we open fire." Carol's eyes roamed over the red brick garage. His body was tense, his neck and forehead damp. He slowly raised his pistol to the firing position. The Vets garage remained quiet. Something definitely wasn't right about this. 25 seconds. "Come out of the garage!" Walter Trentkamp leaned close and forced a whisper. One of the things Carol appreciated was that Walter was still basically a street cop. He still needed to be in on the action himself. "Suppose this is all bullshit? Suppose we've got the wrong men, the wrong messenger service?" Something's not right here, Arch. Carol Stitt said nothing. He was watching and thinking. 20 seconds. Come on, Walter. Come with me. Carol suddenly stepped forward. Walter Trentkamp, somewhat reluctantly, followed him toward the garage doors. The police commissioner had stopped counting down. Then FBI agents and city cops were everywhere, pushing through the jagged edges of the broken doors and into the darkened building itself. Somebody turned on a light, revealing a somewhat ordinary, gloomy, and cavernous garage. Carol, frowning in hand, froze. His eyes blinked several times. He could smell oil and grease, all the harsh odors left behind by sick and aging automobiles. Slick puddles of oil covered the concrete floor. There were professional mechanics' tools lying around in disarray. But nothing else was left in the vet's garage. There were no vehicles on the basement floor. There were no people, no Vietnam veterans. Colonel David Hudson was nowhere to be seen. Nothing was left of whatever had been here before. Carol and Trentkamp wandered around the garage, their guns still clutched in their fists. They entered each small room in a careful police crouch. They finally climbed narrow, twisting stairs to the top floor. And then they both saw it, the message left for them. It was taped to the grease-stained wall, and it mocked them all. It laughed at all the helpless police investigators, a shrill funhouse cackle, the screeching caw of jungle birds. A green ribbon had been tied on a perfect bow, and it hung on a barren wall like something left over from a Christmas package. Yeah, Arch Carol thought. Have a merry one. Green Band had disappeared from the garage on Jane Street. As always, one frustrating jump ahead. One cold, calculating jump. Moving toward what? Chapter 80. Caitlin carried a leather portfolio overflowing with her notes as she walked down the darkened hallway of an Upper West Side apartment building. The door to 12B was halfway open. Anton Birnbaum was there waiting. Caitlin wondered why he had called her so late at night. What did Anton want from her now? He let her in, and they walked together to his library, a room crammed to its high ceiling with old books and periodicals. "Thank you for coming right away," he said. He seemed incredibly relieved to see Caitlin. "Coffee? Tea? I've been living on the unhealthy stuff lately." He gestured to a tarnished espresso pot near the glowing fireplace. Caitlin declined. His hands were trembling slightly. This whole room, in its papery disarray, indicated that Anton Birnbaum had been burning the midnight oil with a fevered vengeance. "Let me begin all the way back in Dallas, Caitlin." Birnbaum, his small face looking like a burned-out moon, finally sat down alongside her. "The tragic assassination of President John Kennedy. It's a good place to start, I think. In terms of the fantastic versus the expected reality, the assassination was probably orchestrated, as we all know. Next comes Watergate, 1973. I think I firmly believe that Watergate was permitted to escalate. Its flames were fanned in order to remove Richard M. Nixon from office. That, my dear, is history. American history." Birnbaum's cup gently rattled in the saucer. "Both these events were clearly orchestrated. Both events were devised by a cabal working both inside and outside the United States government. This elitist group is a remnant, Caitlin, a cell of the old OSS, our own World War II intelligence network. I have heard them called the Wise Men. I've also heard them called the Committee of 12. They exist. Permit me to continue before you comment. In 1945, the men who ran the OSS realized that the cloak of responsibility they had assumed in wartime was coming to an end. They were faced with giving their enormous power back to the same politicians who had almost managed to obliterate the human race a few years before. They had no desire to do so, Caitlin. In many ways, one can almost justify their actions. Birnbaum sipped his coffee. A high-ranking clique of these OSS men surrendered only some of their wartime powers to President Truman. They remained behind the scenes in Washington. They began to maneuver a series of political puppets. These men and their protégés, the current Committee of 12, have gone so far as to select the presidential candidates for political parties. For both parties, Caitlin, in the same election. Caitlin stared at the old man. The wise men? The Committee of 12? A secret cabal with unlimited power? She already knew a great deal about real and imagined government conspiracies. They had always seemed woven into the tapestry of American history. Unconfirmable rumors, uncomfortable realities, uncomfortable whispers in high places. Who are these men, Anton? My dear, they are not exactly faces familiar from Newsweek or Time magazine. But that's beside the point right now. What I am trying to tell you is that I have no doubt this group is involved in the Green Band incident. Somehow, Caitlin, they encouraged or caused the December 4th attack on Wall Street. They are behind whatever is happening right now. Caitlin didn't have the words to respond to what Birnbaum was saying. With any other person, she might have dismissed this whole thing. With Birnbaum, she knew he wouldn't have told her any of this if he wasn't certain himself. The financier stared at Caitlin, and there was an unusually weary glaze over his eyes. This veterans group, Birnbaum started again. You've heard of them already? Caitlin was surprised. An alarm sounded inside her brain. Birnbaum smiled. A slender fissure opened across his small face. My dear, information has always been the wellspring of my success. Of course I have heard of the veterans group. I have my sources inside Number 13. But what I don't know is whether the Committee of 12 manipulated these misfits, or whether the veterans are paid operatives. I do believe I know why the dangerous mission was undertaken. I think it can be traced to a Soviet-run provocateur called François Montserrat, a mass murderer, a killing machine that has to be destroyed. But what is Montserrat's connection with the Committee of 12, Anton? What's going to happen now? Can you tell me that? Anton Birnbaum smiled. For the smile was tight. I believe that I can, my dear. Chapter 81. Early on Sunday morning, David Hudson patrolled the dimly lit corridors of the sprawling Queens VA hospital. The home of the brave, he thought bitterly. The Queens VA was situated at Linden Boulevard and 179th Street. It was a dismal, red-brick complex that called no attention to itself. 11 years before, Hudson had been an outpatient there, one of tens of thousands who had been subjected to VA hospitals after the war. A hollowness, like that at the heart of an empty gymnasium, caused his footsteps to echo as he plunged deeper into the hospital complex. There were buzzing voices, but no people he could see. Ghosts, he thought. Straining voices from another dimension of reality. Voices of cruel pain and madness. He turned a corner, and suddenly he encountered a gruesome row of veterans. There were wraiths, mostly, but a few were overweight. The odor in the still, dead air was overpowering, part industrial disinfectant, part urine, part feces. A synthetic Christmas tree blinked spastically at the heart of the claustrophobic room. At least half of the patients seemed to have tiny metal radios pressed like cold packs to their heads. A black hussar and a torn, pinstriped Johnny was discoing around an amputee fitfully sleeping in his wheelchair. Hudson saw broken, gnarled bodies harnessed into steel and leather braces. Metals of honor, the hospital aides used to say when Hudson had been there. He felt such rage now, such hatred for everything American, everything he'd once loved about his country. There was still no hospital personnel in sight. There wasn't a single corpsman, not a nurse or a nurse's aide in any of the halls. David Hudson kept walking, faster, almost hearing a soft military drum roll in his head. He went down a bright yellow hallway, a falsely cheery one. He remembered all of the surroundings with clarity now. Almost uncontrollable rage swept through his body. In the fall of 1973, he'd been admitted into the VA, ostensibly for psychiatric evaluation and tests. A smug doctor had talked to him twice about his affliction, his unfortunate loss of an arm. The Army doctor was equally interested in Hudson's POW experience. Had he killed a Viet Cong camp commandant while making his escape? Yes, Hudson assured him. In fact, the escape was what had first brought him to the attention of Army intelligence. They had tested him in Vietnam, then they sent him back to Fort Bragg for further training. The interviews lasted no more than 50 minutes each time. Hudson had then filled out endless Veterans Administration questionnaires and numbered forms. He was assigned a VA caseworker, an obese man with a birthmark on his cheek, whom he never saw again after their first half-hour interview. At the end of the yellow hallway were glass double doors to the outside. Through the hospital doors, Hudson could see fenced-in back lawns. The fences were not intended to keep the veterans in, he knew. They'd been built to keep the people outside from seeing what was inside, the terrifying, awful disgrace of America's veterans. David Hudson hit the glass door squarely with his right shoulder. He was instantly plunged outside into sharp winter cold, into the dark, clinging dampness. Directly behind the main hospital building was a steep, frost-covered lawn which ended in threadbare scrub pines. Hudson moved across it quickly. "Concentrate," he instructed himself. "Don't think about anything but the present. Nothing but what's happening right now." Two men stepped suddenly from behind a row of thickly snow-laden firs. Chapter 82. One man had the formal appearance of a United Nations diplomat. The other was a common-looking street thug with a tough, expressionless face.
"You might have chosen the Oak Bar at the Plaza just as easily. Certainly that would have been more convenient." The impressive-looking man spoke first.
"Colonel Hudson, I presume?"
"I am Montserrat."
The distinguished man's English was accented. He might have been French, Swiss,
Montserrat.
Hudson smiled without any real mirth. He showed slightly parted teeth. Every one of his senses was coming alive now.
"The next time we meet, it can be your turn to choose locations. Under the clock in the Biltmore Hotel, the observation deck of the Empire State Building. Whatever sight pleases you," he offered.
"I'll remember that. You have a proposition for me to consider, Colonel. The remainder of the securities from Green Band? A substantial amount, I take it." Hudson's eyes remained hooded, showing almost no emotion, not a hint of the seething rage inside.
"Yes, I would say substantial. Over $4 billion.
That's enough to cause an unprecedented international incident."
"Whatever you wish."
"And what do you want from us, dare I ask?"
"What is your reward out of this, Colonel?"
"Less than you might think.
The deposit of $150 million in a secure, numbered account. Your assurance that the GRU won't pursue my men afterward. The end of Green Band, as far as you're concerned.
That's all?
I can't accept that.
No, I suppose it isn't all. I have something else in mind. You see, I want you to destroy the pathetic American way of life. I want you to end the American century a little early. We both hate the American system, at least what it's become. We both want to set it on fire, to purify the world. We've been trained to accomplish that.
The terrorist stared into Colonel Hudson's eyes. Hudson's apocalyptic words hung in the chilled air.
Finally, Montserrat smiled. He understood Hudson perfectly now.
You're planning to complete this transaction soon, I take it?
The exchange?
Hudson looked at his wristwatch as if to check the time. He knew precisely what time it was. He was only going through the motions.
It's 10:30 now, in 6 hours, gentlemen.
End of side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.
Side 7. Black Friday by James Patterson. Continuing on page 369. Montserrat hesitated, an uncharacteristic flicker of indecision and doubt, but only a second's pause.
6 hours is acceptable. We will be ready by then. Is that all?
Hudson seemed to have a sudden insight as he stood huddled with the two men. His head cocked slowly, at an odd angle. A smile finally appeared, full of charm, his old West Point charisma.
There is another matter, one more serious problem we have to discuss.
And what might that be, Colonel Hudson?
I realize that no one is supposed to know who you are. That's the primary reason I wanted you here, why I insisted on it. If you were to get the bulk of these bonds, you see me, and I see you. Except for one thing.
Except what?
Next time, I want to see the real François Montserrat. If he doesn't come in person, there will be no exchange.
Having said that, David Hudson turned away. Hudson walked briskly back toward the VA hospital and disappeared inside. His revenge, his 15-year odyssey, was almost complete now. The final, telling moment was coming.
Deceit, as it had never been seen before, not since the war anyway. They had taught him so very, very well to destroy whatever he wished to destroy.
Chapter 83.
In a fashionable and expensive part of New York City, Vice President Elliott was alone and troubled that morning. He walked at a quickening pace along the edge of the East River, directly behind the United Nations complex. There was the customary parade of bundled-up joggers plodding along the concrete promenade. A spinsterish woman looked like she might be contemplating suicide. A slender young model walked her dog. There were no bodyguards for the Vice President of the United States. No crew-cut Secret Service men were anywhere in sight. There was nothing and nobody to protect Thomas Elliott from recognition and possibly from harm. The walk alone was something the Vice President did infrequently, but it was something he needed to do now. It was a fundamental human need, simply to be alone. Thomas Elliott needed to be able to think, to be able to see a complex and challenging plan in its entirety. The Vice President finally let his mind settle on the real reason why he desperately needed to be off by himself. He paused and stared into the sluggish, wintry gray river. Smoke drifted lazily upward on the other bank. He thought about his childhood then, as if those comforting recollections might put everything in perspective. The casual rise of smoke reminded him of those autumnal bonfires on the grounds of his family home in Connecticut. How could that boy, whose face he saw in memory, have come all this way, all the way to this seminal moment in American history? Vice President Elliott placed his gloved hands in the pockets of his overcoat. Greenband was almost at an end. Out there, someplace in this vast city, the terrorist, Francois Montserrat, the New York police, Colonel David Hudson and his men were rushing toward their rendezvous with destiny. Meanwhile, other powerful forces were sliding quietly into place. He frowned. A barge crawled over the oily surface of the river. Dirty washing hung on a rope and smoke rose upward from a blunt funnel. The vice president thought he saw a shapeless figure move aboard the barge. Colonel David Hudson had his moment of destiny to come. As did he, the vice president of this country. In a very short time, when the dust had cleared on the brief reign of Justin Kearney, a disillusioned man who hadn't been able to come to terms with the limitations of his power, a man who would resign his office in the wake of an economic crisis, who would be exiled to some rustic estate and live out the remainder of his days writing heavily censored memoirs. When all the dust had cleared, Thomas Moore Elliott, like Lyndon Baines Johnson 20-odd years before, like Gerald Ford a little more than a decade ago, would step up to the presidency of the United States. Everything depended on the final act of Greenband. Chapter 84. The Vets cabs appeared suddenly. They paraded single file out of an abandoned warehouse garage in downtown Manhattan. The cabs were assimilated into normal traffic flow until they branched onto Division and Catherine Streets leading toward the East River and FDR Drive. Each of the checker cabs had been equipped with PRC-77 transmitter receivers, known in Vietnam as monsters. The PRC units automatically scrambled and unscrambled all transmissions. There was no way the New York police could intercept messages traveling between the cabs. There were 6 cabs, which could carry 14 heavily armed vets, an assault platoon with rifleman snipers, M60 gas-operated machine gunners, a thumper man with an M79 grenade launcher, a communications operator. The most spectacular touch in the commando raid was that the ground attack force had air support. 2 Cobra assault copters would be backing the vets if any combat action started on the street. David Hudson, who scouted and studied the street from the lead cab, was beginning to feel an unexpected sense of release. It was almost over. Finally, dignity. Finally, revenge. He experienced some of his old combat sensations from Vietnam, only this time with a difference. A big, important difference. This time, they were going to be allowed to win. A New York police detective, Ernie Cowboy Tubbs, who had been dragged unceremoniously out of bed to join the manhunt, saw one of the cabs go past on Division Street. Then he saw 2 more vets' cabs. He turned to his partner, Detective Maury Klein, a short man in a black tent of a raincoat. Tubbs said, "Christ, that's them. That's Greenband. Bingo, Maury." Detective Klein, who was addicted to Rolaids and Pepto-Bismol, peered sorrowfully through the windshield. His stomach was already killing him. "Jesus Christ, Ernie. Half those bastards are supposed to be special forces." Ernie Cowboy Tubbs shrugged and swung their late-model Dodge out behind the line of yellow cab. Only a single car separated them from the rear-guard vet's cab. "We spotted Greenband," Tubbs rasped into the hand mic on his dashboard. Maury Klein uneasily cradled an American 180 submachine gun in both arms. The assault gun looked out of place inside the Dodge middle-class family car. The American 180 fired 30 rounds per second. It was never used in city fighting for that reason. "This sucks, man. Sucks. Bar on 125th Street. I tangled with 1 Green Beret Special Forces dude. That was enough for me, forever." Maury Klein continued to complain. The notion of mixing it up with ex-Special Forces veterans seemed like one of the worst ideas he'd ever had in his police force life. Maury Klein was a vet, too, class of 53, Korea. At Henry Street, there were only a few working traffic lights, There was almost no other traffic. An eerie, dockside feeling pervaded the steamy gray area of lower Manhattan. Looks like they're going to the FDR Drive for sure. Entrance is down here somewhere, right around Houston. North or south? Ernie Tubbs yelled to his partner and gave a quick glance. I think both ways. South for sure. We'll see it here any... There. That's it. Just then, Tubbs spotted the dilapidated ramp to the south lanes of the drive himself. The Vets calves were approaching fast from both directions. The first calves were already rattling up the crumbling stone and metal rampways. Tubbs flicked on his hand mic again. Contact. All units. They're getting on the FDR. They're heading due south. Over. Suddenly, the rear Vets cab veered sharply. It tried to cut Tubbs' car off. Son of a bitch. Tubbs swerved left with skillful, near-perfect timing. The unmarked police sedan continued to shoot up the half-blocked entranceway that didn't look wide enough anymore. Jesus Christ, Ernie! Watch the walls! The Vets cab, meanwhile, had finished its tailspin. It was blocking off every police car except one, Tubbs's, which had somehow slipped by. Son of a bitch! Son of a bitch! Detective Tubbs yelled as he fought the unmarked car's steering wheel for control. All units! All units! They set a roadblock on the FDR! Repeat! There's a roadblock on the FDR! Over! Meanwhile, the single police sedan was screeching into teeming traffic filling all three narrow, twisting lanes of the FDR south. A truck slammed to a jolting stop behind. Horns blared from every possible direction. The police car was hemmed in tight by two of the Vets' cabs. The black barrels of M16s were jammed out both windows of the cab to their left. Ernie Tubbs couldn't breathe. He was bottled in at 55 miles an hour. One of the M16s fired a round. The warning shot flared over the police sedan roof like night tracers in a combat battle zone. A Vet in military khakis and black grease paint screamed over at Tubbs. His voice was muffled under the traffic whistle, but Tubbs could hear every word. Get off at the next stop! Get the fuck off this road! Everybody but the driver, hands up! I said hands up! Hands up! Closing on the next exit, Tubbs spun his wheel hard right toward the guardrail. The unmarked police sedan shot at a 70-degree angle toward the off-ramp. It bumped hard over loose plates, sending off sparks. The patrol car went up on two wheels. It threatened to turn over. After a moment when gravity seemed an indecisive force, the car finally bounced back onto all four wheels. It shimmied down the off-ramp, then stopped dead on the bordering city street. We lost them. Over. Tubbs screamed into his radio transmitter. We lost them on the FDR. Detective Maury Klein finally whispered out loud inside the police sedan. Thank fucking God. Chapter 85. As soon as he heard the news that Green Van had been spotted, Carroll spun down several steep flights of stairs inside number 13. He took the rubber-edged steps two and three at a time. He was racing outside, hoping to find a police helicopter waiting. Everything was happening at once on the street. Crashing footsteps of other running men, police squad car engines starting, tires screeching up and down Wall Street and Broad and water. Carroll was carting an M16 rifle, which felt weird bouncing against his body. Flashback time. He was an Army infantry soldier again. Except for one thing. This was downtown Manhattan and not Vietnam. His sports coat flew open as he ran, revealing the Browning holster as well as a bulletproof vest. His heart was pounding at a volume consistent with the street noise. A radio squad car he passed relayed the latest information on Green Van's whereabouts. They're moving at about 35 miles per hour. Six vehicles. They're all regular checker cabs. All are heavily armed. They are proceeding east. It's a setup for something else, Carroll thought. What though? What were the Vets going to do now? What was Hudson's plan? A silver and black Bell helicopter was waiting in a Kinney parking lot. A few weeks earlier, the parking lot would have been filled with the luxury cars of Wall Street workaholics. The police helicopter was whirring like an outsized moth. It was ready to fly. M-16 and a Bell chopper. Carol winced as he swung his body inside the hot, cramped helicopter cockpit. Christ, this brings back memories. Hi, I'm Carol, he said to the police pilot seated inside. Luther Parrish, the pilot grunted. He was NYPD, a heavy-set black man with a leather flak jacket and clear yellow goggle glasses. You ex-Vietnam? You look like it. Feel like it. Parrish snapped a thick wad of gum as he talked. Class of 1970, Carol finally smiled. He played up a little combat cool, like you would boarding a copter in Nam. The truth was, he hated choppers. He hated seeing the goddamn thing. Carol didn't like the idea of being suspended in air with nothing to rely on but slender blades that furiously slashed the air. How about that? Class of 72. Well, here we go again, sports fan. I take it you don't much like airplane rides. Before Carol had a chance to answer in the extreme negative, the Bell copter jumped straight up from the parking lot cement. The ascent left Carol's small intestine somewhere behind. The chopper pierced the smoky city morning, hugging the dusky walls of nearby buildings. The pilot cleverly avoided swift winds sweeping off the river. Then the copter swung out wide toward the East River. A second helicopter, another Bell, joined in from due south. No, I'm not real crazy about helicopters. No offense, Luther. Adrenaline flowed wildly. It raged like a flooding river through Carol's body. Down below, he could see traffic streaming on the FDR highway. The police pilot eventually spoke up over the rotor's noise. Beautiful morning, man. You can see Long Island, Connecticut. Almost see Paris, France. Beautiful morning to get shot in the fucking heart. The black pilot snorted out a laugh. You've been to Vietnam, all right. Let's see. We've got 2-3 armed patrol helicopters on them right now. Pick up more help once we find out which borough they're going to. I think we'll be fine. I hope you're right, Luther. You see them down there? Little toy taxicab? See? See right there? Yeah, with little toy M-16s, toy rocket launchers, Carol said to the pilot. You talk just like ex-infantry. Ironic type shit, making me all misty-eyed. Still infantry from the look of things, except I'm afraid we're fighting the Green Berets today. The pilot turned to Carol with a knowing look. They're bad dudes, all right. Definitely special forces. He nodded as if to a secret beat. He almost seemed proud of the vet's bravado. Their street fighting style had hit a chord. 1,000 feet below, the FDR drive was a delicate ribbon of silver and shiny jet black. The vet's cab looked intensely yellow, almost tawdry down there. As the lineup of cabs crossed the Brooklyn Bridge, both Bell helicopters swung high and wide to avoid being seen. The copters actually briefly disappeared into low-flying clouds. Carol's shirt was already soaked through. Everything seemed to be happening at a distance. The world was slightly fuzzed and unreal. They were going to solve Green Band after all. On the Brooklyn side of the bridge, he could see that traffic was heavy but moving. The steady whoosh of cars and occasional bleating horn traveled all the way up to the helicopter cockpit. They're getting off at the Navy Yard exit. This is Carol to control. The vet's convoy is exiting at the Navy Yard. They're proceeding northeast into Brooklyn, Carol screeched into the microphone. Chapter 86. At that same instant, a deafening explosion jarred the underbelly of the police helicopter with a jolt that seemed to rattle right through Carol's bones. His head cracked hard against the metal roof and sharp bolts of pain stabbed behind his eyes. Then a second jarring blast struck the reverberating cockpit. Splinters of glass flew in all directions. Star fractures cobwebbed across the windshield. Everywhere, metal was ringing with gunshots. Glaring red flashes were angrily riveting the sky.
"Oh, goddamn! I'm hit! I'm hit!" the pilot moaned as he slumped forward.
Meanwhile, a machine gun loudly chattered off to Carol's left. Carol caught a brief glimpse of floating, blinking red lamps on the right and the hulking shapes of two choppers he hadn't seen before.
Christ! Two Cobras were attacking them.
Suddenly, the sky was filled with bright, jarring yellow orbs of light, with roaring fire and billowing black smoke. The companion police helicopter had disintegrated before Carol's disbelieving eyes. Where the chopper had hovered just seconds before, there was nothing except for leaping gold and orange flames. Nothing was left, except this eerie, fading after-image in the sky. Carol could see that Luther Parrish had been hit badly. Puddles of blood were collecting from a wound somewhere on the left side of his head. The electric circuits in the helicopter cockpit seemed to be useless. Heavy machine gun fire welled up from below. The pilot temporarily revived, moaning, grabbed both his legs. The helicopter had begun to fall, to somersault and plummet helplessly. Parrish didn't notice. Carol fired his M-16 at one of the attacking Cobras. The red light winked derisively. Then the copter calmly disappeared from sight. Carol froze. He was pressed extremely hard into his helicopter seat. Blood was rushing, swirling through his head. The police helicopter had suddenly flipped completely upside down. Then the helicopter was on a dead fall, sailing and spinning into the gauzy gray nothingness of the Brooklyn Navy Yard below. A flat, black rooftop with a water tower mounted on it suddenly loomed enormously, coming as fast as another airplane at the copter's windshield. The flailing helicopter skimmed over an expanse of shadowy factory building, a block long, at least. It missed a smoking industrial chimney by inches. The copter's tail was clipped off by a high brick retaining wall. A deserted grid of avenues and streets appeared through the windshield as the helicopter cleared the last building. Cars were parked in long, uneven lines up both sides. Carol reflexively grabbed at the controls. He knew what everything was, from too many trips in Vietnam, though not how to really use any of it. His body was trembling. Deep, jolting spasms flew up his spine. He was beyond any compartment of fear he'd previously known, beyond anything he'd felt in combat or police action. He was in a new realm of sensation, a clear, hard place where he seemed acutely conscious of everything going on around him. This was the moment of impending death, he thought, without real comprehension. The helicopter's belly cleanly sheared the rooftops off a half-dozen parked cars. Carol covered his face. He shielded the wounded police pilot as best he could with his body. The helicopter struck the street on a side angle. It skidded, bounded violently. The copter's belly issued a grinding shriek, and Carol could feel his blood turn to ice. Sparks, plumes of intense red flames, flew in every possible direction. Whole sides of parked automobiles, headlights, and bumpers were effortlessly cut away. A red fire hydrant popped out of the cement like a bathtub plug. The police helicopter, skidding on its side, finally slowed. It plowed to a tearing, screaming, crunching halt up against two crushed compact cars. A man in a factory security uniform was running crazily, zigzagging down the deserted street toward the unbelievable accident.
"Hey, hey! That's my car! That's my car!"
Carol was cradling the badly wounded pilot. "Grab hold. You just hold me," he whispered, hoping the man wasn't already dead. "Just hold me, Luther." Then he was limping away from the burning helicopter wreckage. He was half dragging, half carrying the hulking NYPD pilot in his arms. His eyes nervously searched the skies for the attacking Vets Cobras, but there was nothing there now. Nothing at all. The choppers might as well have been the vehicles of some unlikely nightmare. It was like being in the war again. It was exactly like combat duty. Except that the helicopter crash had happened right here on the streets of Brooklyn. Chapter 87.
The vet's cabs proceeded northeast, then almost due east across Brooklyn. They were moving inexorably toward Montserrat. They were headed toward the appointed end of Green Band. Erect and alert behind the wheel, David Hudson was experiencing a moment of anxiety. It had something to do with being this close to the end. They were less than 7 minutes from the rendezvous point with Montserrat. Hudson tried to concentrate as if he were entering a combat zone. Nothing could distract him from Green Band now. Nothing could look mildly suspicious either. Montserrat's soldiers could be watching the streets from neighborhood rooftops and darkened apartment windows. If they spotted the attack force, the final exchange of Wall Street securities wouldn't happen. Green Band would fail. Like an advance scout, Hudson checked and rechecked the squat, cheerless brick buildings as he drove closer to the meeting place. Hudson noted everything. A knot of youths was easing out of Turner's Grill. Their voices carried low, guttural sounds in syncopated street rhythm. Hudson drove slowly on. He found a parking spot further down the slope-shouldered Bedford-Stuyvesant side street. He parked and climbed out of the car. He continued to look around the quiet neighborhood chosen for the meeting. He finally popped open the cab's dented and scarred trunk. The Wall Street securities were there in ordinary-looking gray vinyl suitcases. Hudson hoisted up the bags, and he began to trudge as rapidly as he could toward a red brick factory at the next street corner. He was almost certain he was being watched. Montserrat was nearby. All his senses and instincts corroborated that single message. This was the moment of reckoning, then. All of Hudson's special forces training to be matched against Montserrat's experience, his deceit. Hudson shouldered open the wood front door of a building which housed shabby apartments and a small Italian-American shoe factory, the Gino Company of Milano. He pushed into a dark hallway where trapped cooking smells immediately assaulted him. The musty scent of old winter clothes hung in the air. The meeting place seemed appropriately isolated. "Don't turn around, Colonel." Three men appeared in the dim corridor with magnums and berettas drawn. "Move up against the wall. That's good. Right there." "That will be fine, Colonel Hudson." The leader had a Spanish accent, more than likely Cuban. Montserrat ran the Caribbean and most of the terrorists' activities in South America. At the rate he was going one day, Montserrat was going to run the entire Third World. "I'm not armed," Hudson said. "Have to search you anyway." One of the men positioned himself less than 3 feet away from Hudson. He pointed his gun at an imaginary spot between Hudson's eyes. It was a popular gunman's trick, one Hudson himself had been taught at Fort Bragg. At close range, shoot out the eyes. The second man patted him down. The third man searched the gray suitcases, slashing them with a knife, looking for false siding, a bottom that wasn't actually a bottom. "Upstairs," the terrorist who held the gun finally commanded Hudson. He spoke like a military officer. They began to climb a steep and creaking flight of stairs, then another flight. Were they leading him to Montserrat? Finally, the enigmatic Montserrat himself? Or would there be more deception? "This is your floor, Colonel. That door straight ahead. You can just walk inside. You're most definitely expected." "Point of information. I have a question for you, for all of you. Curiosity on my part." David Hudson spoke without turning to face his escort group. An impatient grunt came from behind. "The lizard man. Past interrogations. Special army training." Hudson's mind continued to churn at a furious rate. All to prepare him for this very moment? Do they ever tell you what's really happening? Has anyone bothered to tell you the truth about this operation? Do you know what this meeting really is? Do you know why? David Hudson was introducing some element of doubt into their minds, petty doubts and confusion, paranoid unease
he could use later, if he needed to. Deception. Always deception.
Don't bother to knock, Colonel. The man in charge calmly spoke again. Just go right in. You're expected. Everything you try to do is expected, Colonel.
A slice of dull, yellow light emanated from within as David Hudson peered inside the fourth-floor tenement room. Hudson paused at the doorway's edge. He was about to confront the mysterious and dangerous Montserrat. He was about to conclude Green Band's appointed business to end his mission. The Viet Cong's lizard man had taught Hudson an essential lesson in Vietnam. It was to play games in which your opponent wasn't given the rules. This was the principle behind all successful guerrilla warfare. Colonel David Hudson versus Montserrat. Now it began.
Chapter 88. All blue and white units, we picked them up again. We've got our friends, Green Band.
NYPD cruiser radios echoed brassily above the noise of whining police and hospital emergency sirens at the helicopter crash site near the Brooklyn Navy Yard.
They're moving into a residential neighborhood, Bedford-Stuyvesant. It's right in the heart of the fucking ghetto. They're traveling on Halsey Street in Bed-Stuy now. Over.
Carol sagged heavily against the open front door of one of the half-dozen police cruisers that had arrived after the helicopter accident. Crime scene technicians were already swarming onto the fire-lit street. He wasn't sure if he'd heard the radio report right.
Green Band appeared. Green Band disappeared.
Which was it?
Carol tried to clear the gauze from his head as he listened to the minute-by-minute updates squawking over nearby police cruiser radios. He couldn't feel any recognizable emotion. His regular system of response to stimuli had come to a halt. He was beyond pain as he'd known it before. The police helicopter pilot had been carried on a litter into a waiting EMS ambulance. KIA, Carol was almost certain.
Carol? You're Arch Carol, aren't you? Do you want to go with me?
I'm heading to Halsey Street. It's about 10 minutes from here.
A police captain, a plump, white-haired man Carol knew from a saner niche in his life, came up alongside him.
Carol knew he appeared dazed and confused. In fact, he felt far worse than that, but he nodded.
Yes, he definitely wanted to witness the end. He had to be there. Colonel Hudson, Montserrat, Carol, they all had to be there, didn't they?
Why was that? Why had everything led to this point, like veins of glass back toward the impact point in a shatter?
A moment or so later, he was hunched forward in a police patrol car, feeling like he might be sick. Hammers of fear were tripping off inside his head.
The police cruiser lurched into motion. The flashing light began to revolve, cherry red. The siren of the speeding car warbled above the rooftops of Brooklyn.
Chapter 89. This was the master, Montserrat.
Hudson could not believe what his eyes told him was true.
Montserrat? Or was this more misdirection? Another trick? The highest manifestation of deception?
Smoke sifted through his mind, obscuring his vision, scrambling his understanding.
And there was renewed tension, an electric tingling in his fingertips, his arms, his legs.
He watched the dark-suited figure come forward toward him. He noted the gunmen who waited in shadows against the far wall.
Colonel Hudson. The handshake was quick, firm.
I'm Francois Montserrat. The real one this time.
A smile played at the corners of the terrorist's mouth. It was the most confident and assured look David Hudson had ever witnessed.
Montserrat's smile dimmed.
Let's get to business. I believe we can complete our transaction quickly.
Look at what he's brought, Marcel.
Rapidement.
Another person in a suit stepped inside the room at Montserrat's command. The man was perhaps 60 and had the pallid complexion
the weak eyesight of someone who spends much of life looking through the lenses of microscopes and magnifying glasses. He bent low to examine the securities Hudson had brought with him. Hudson watched closely as he rubbed the individual trading bonds carefully, lightly testing their texture between his thumb and forefinger. He smelled selected bonds, testing for fresh ink, for any unusually pungent odors, anything that would suggest too recent printing. He worked extremely fast. Each minute, nevertheless, passed with excruciating slowness. "For the most part, the bonds are authentic," he finally looked up and spoke to Montserrat. "Any problems at all?" "I have a slight question about the Morgan guarantee, perhaps about the smaller Lehman Brothers lot. I think there are possibly some counterfeit papers in those stacks. As you know, there are always some counterfeits," he added. "Everything else is quite in order." Francois Montserrat nodded curtly. Even Montserrat seemed uneasy now. The terrorist picked up the plain black telephone on the table. Montserrat dialed the telephone company business office, gave a 4-digit number, then spoke to what was clearly an overseas operator. Seconds later, the terrorist was speaking directly to someone obviously known at a bank in Geneva, Switzerland. "My account number is 411FA. Make the agreed-upon deposit into the account." Less than 4 minutes later, Montserrat hung up. Moments afterward, the phone rang and Hudson received a confirmation that the money had indeed been successfully transferred in Europe. Over $200 million had gone out of the Soviet accounts into special accounts opened by the vets in London, Paris, Amsterdam, and Madrid. Vets 28, Thomas O'Neill, the customs chief of Shannon Airport, had come through again. The green band plan was perfect. "Colonel, I believe our business is concluded. You seem to have won each round. This time, anyway." Montserrat executed a deferential bow. As Hudson stood up from the table, he felt that a terrible weight had finally been lifted. He was free of an obsession he'd carried for almost 15 years. At that exact moment, he was silently counting down to zero. Green Band was almost at an end. Almost, but not quite. Just one more twist, one final surprise. Deception at its best. Chapter 90. Less than 40 seconds remained.